When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
"100% Hockey" with Millard and Shannon, where we have been working in lockstep with the Florida Panthers, partying every hour, every day, right along with them. I love how teams now, like, it's not just a celebration for a couple of days. It's a week-long party, and I don't know how the players do it, to be quite honest.
I'm not sure they do.
No. I watched it firsthand, and every day they were doing something going into the National Hockey League draft. So that 10-day window.
I can tell you from personal experience. In 1984 was the first time the Edmonton Oilers won the Stanley Cup, and I didn't live in Edmonton, but I stayed after they won the Cup. And I ended up staying a whole week. And everywhere we went, the Cup showed up.
Did you drink out of it?
No.
Didn't?
No, I didn't win it.
What's the sense of being around it if you're not going to drink out of it?
It's for the players. It's not for
me. I drank out of it before I was with the team that won it. No, I didn't hold it over my head until
I drank out of the cup years ago when it was in my apartment. So
it was in your apartment?
Sure.
Really?
Yeah.
Like the Stanley Cup?
Yeah, I have a picture here somewhere. Oh, yeah.
Why? Why was it there?
So we had a young group of guys working at Hockey Night in Canada, and we needed to go to the Hall of Fame to pick the cup up to then shoot it for television, you know, put it on a pedestal on a turntable and have it rotate, and you saw it on TV. And so they said, okay, you guys go pick up the cup and bring it to the studio on Saturday. So we picked it up Friday at noon.
And the Hall of Fame was like, fine.
Yeah.
Do you have to sign it out?
Nope. Oh, we just came. You're the guys from Hockey Night in Canada. Come and get the cup. So Lefty Reed gave us the cup in the big box, and we took it home, and we phoned all of our friends. We've got the Stanley Cup, and people said, there's no way you've got the Stanley Cup. True story.
That's outstanding.
So I have one picture somewhere where I have a California Golden Seals sweater. And... So this was the last year of the Golden Seals in the National Hockey League. So I had my friend present me with the Stanley Cup because it was going to be the one and only time where the Golden Seals were given the Stanley Cup.
Can you find that picture and post it?
I'll try to find it.
Would you get in trouble for posting that?
No.
Okay. Can you do that for us listening?
I'll try to find it.
Talking to you? You're the reason why now there's a cup keeper. That's the real reason why it was put in place.
Well, no, there were the Edmonton Oilers were the real reason why there's a cup keeper. The Edmonton Oilers, because Glenn Sather was one of those guys that said, boys, it's your trophy. You go, you've earned it. You go have fun with it. And I mean, it went everywhere. It went to people's houses. It went to strip joints. It went to hotels. It went everywhere with the Oilers for that first cup for sure in 84.
I thought Eugene Principe and I getting the Grey Cup overnight at our place when we were roommates was a cool thing, but that just one-upped me.
Sorry.
No, it's all right. That's a cool story. News around the National Hockey League. The Florida Party, Dallas Stars.
It's not over yet. Yeah, the Florida Party's not over yet.
Well, the Dallas Stars name a new head coach before the Florida Panthers. And Paul Maurice with the two cats on his shirt this year. He told me he had something up his sleeve to play off last year with a cat picture from his daughter. That was the cool from his daughter's cat. Will the Dallas Stars have a coach before the Florida Party ends?
Oh, no, because the Florida Party won't end until ring presentations. So the ring presentations will be in October. The party will go on in Florida forever.
Okay, what are we hearing about the Stars head coach?
Well, there's three guys on the staff that they have interviewed already. Your pal, Misha.
Misha Donskoff.
Alan Nasruddin. And then Neil Graham, who was in Austin with their American League team. So those three inside the organization have had interviews. I think there are lots of people pushing for Glenn Gullitson, who is, by the way, a former Dallas Stars head coach, but that was a long time ago. Glenn Gullitson to get a look. He probably deserves it after the yeoman's work he's done with or in and around the Edmonton Oilers the last 7 or 8 years.
Love my gully. And Misha is a good buddy of mine. Never been a head coach in the National Hockey League. And I hear really good things about Alain Nasruddin.
Yes. Yeah.
I don't know much about Neil.
I had heard at times that the strength of Graham was that he was great with young people. Mm-hmm. Now, the challenge in Dallas is that you've got a really good bunch of young guys, but then you got, you know, in theory, Jamie Benn, who's still an unrestricted free agent, but he's going to sign. Matt Duchene, Tyler Seguin, they've got a bunch of veteran players that have to be massaged too.
Graham's been with that organization a long time. Burakovsky traded.
Yeah, more trades. Again, we're seeing trades occur now because I think that would be a trade I would have suggested would have occurred on the draft floor on Friday if everybody was under the same roof. Mm-hmm. And so getting everybody's ducats in a row for cap space and for prospects, and Burakovsky could be a really good ad for Chicago. It could help them. They're trying to create, you know, with a new coach, trying to create a core of players that can help, you know, the Connor Bedards, the Frankie Nizars get to the next level.
Remember we had Pat Verbeek on talking about some of their players.
Yeah.
And just news coming out as we talk that Trevor Zegras is being moved to the Philadelphia Flyers. I don't think it's a huge shock that Zegras was being shopped or would end up with new scenery, but the Anaheim Ducks and Philadelphia Flyers have turned into pretty significant trade partners over the last couple of years.
Yeah. Danny Briere and Pat Verbeek, I don't think they ever played together, but they certainly have plans in place for both of their teams. It's funny. I have, quite frankly, never been a big Zegras fan. But in many ways, you have to think that where the Flyers are in their development with a couple of the young guys that they have going, that Trevor Zegras can help the fan base there enjoy the game a little bit more for a while. He's a talented guy, no question. I just didn't see the way that Joel Quenneville wants to coach and the way Pat Verbeek wants to that team to play that Trevor Zegras fit in.
But doesn't really mesh with a Flyer philosophy either at first blush. We'll see what Rick does, our buddy Talk
but
and company.
There's always a belief that guys see a young player and say, yeah, we can make him play our way.
Well, it doesn't spill right into what we're going to talk about with Sam Cosentino is patience. Like Trevor Zegras in a couple of years could end up being with one of those guys where why weren't the Anaheim Ducks more patient? Or do you sell while you can because you feel you need the change?
Listen, this is a watershed moment, I think, for the Ducks. I think you and I agree that we like the way the Ducks are going, where they're going. Pat Verbeek knew he had to make a coaching change to get to the next level, to get them in contention. But that also means they have to change a little bit of the way they play the game. And Joel Quenneville's style I don't think really would have been benefited by Trevor Zegras's way of playing the game. I really don't. And so Pat, it's funny when Pat was on, you got a sense that he was still in that trade mode.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, Zegras has always been in a discussion for the last 18 months whether Zegras was going to last as a Duck. So he and his pal, Chris Kreider, they work out together. They were teammates for 10 days.
Coming up from behind the net with your stick up is nothing new for a Philadelphia Flyer. It's just didn't see the Michigan happening with it.
No. So by the way, speaking of that, did you watch on the TNT feed or ESPN the Untuckit commercials? Did you ever see those on? Where the guy was trying to do a Michigan, and here's how you. And he was trying to show people how to defend a Michigan. The best they were for Untuckit.
I never saw that version.
Oh, they were the funniest TV commercials in the whole playoffs. They were fantastic. Really?
No, I did not see those on
Untuckit.
Our coverage.
And this guy was an old time hockey guy. He could have been a guy in the old arena in Brandon, Manitoba, teaching you about hockey. He was really good. They were great commercials to the point where I wanted to go out and buy some Untuckit shirts.
You'd be good Untucked.
No,
just loosen up a little bit.
I think you got
some range there. I'm giving you a compliment here. I'd like to see it.
Boy, I tell you what, I'd like to see when you're not complimenting me.
No, I am being complimentary. I'd like to see the casual John. You know what? We need a couple of good cold beers together in the same room to rekindle our friendship. Sam's here. It's hot there.
Hot here.
Yeah, so I wasn't sure whether he would be doing it from the back patio or have the air conditioning blasting, but he has logged in. So we'll get to Sam Cosentino, the draft expert from Sportsnet, getting set for the National Hockey League draft in Los Angeles, remote draft this year. It continues 100% Hockey with Millard and Shannon.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
It's one of the marquee days on the NHL calendar. It really does start the next season. That is the signal. It's the National Hockey League draft. And this year it's going to be a little different as the teams will all remain at their headquarters. Here's Sam Cosentino from Sportsnet, who's covered the draft for as long as the draft has been around. Is that correct, Sam?
Yeah, I wish that were the case. I'm not quite that old, but
some of us are.
Feel it.
I remember going to the draft when it was at the Queen Elizabeth Hotel in Montreal. So,
what was Bobby Orr's draft combine interview like?
Stop. Bobby Orr was Sam, you'll know this because you're a trivia freak too. I think Bobby Orr was a C card. He wasn't drafted. I think he was a sponsored kid. Doug Orr wrote a letter to the Maple Leafs and wrote a letter to the Bruins, and the Maple Leafs had no interest, and the Bruins responded. And they signed a 12-year-old Bobby Orr to a C-card.
That's crazy. Oh, my goodness. I mean, how many pull-ups could he do at the combine, I guess?
It doesn't matter. Obviously, it doesn't matter, right?
That's one of the great stories of the draft combine. And now look at how it turned out.
Yeah, pretty good. He's done this twice in a row. That's pretty good. And he's about to cash in for another 7, 8, 9, or 10 million bucks a year.
We're obviously talking about Sam Bennett, who Sam Cosentino knows very well from his days in Kingston. And he was coming out. He came out of the OHL. He was supposed to be a high, you know, octane forward. He was supposed to be a big scorer, and he had to change his game, Sam. And isn't that one of the challenges of the draft?
It sure is. It's like you're projected to be someone because, you know, it's inevitable that you're going to hear all the hype and all the media, and you're going to hear what scouts are saying about you. And you might have a different version of what you think you should be than what your team thinks you should be. And so trying to balance what those two things are, I think is a real challenge. And sometimes in certain situations, Sam Bennett is a great example of that. You know, it's just getting away from the expectations and the bar set by others for you in that organization to realize exactly what you are and what you do well. I mean, you know, again, we're talking about Sam Bennett. Like, he's one of the greatest players of our era, but the reality is in the regular season, he's really a 50-point guy, if that. Mm-hmm. And in the playoffs, obviously amazing things here, and, you know, winning the MVP and going that route is a fascinating, fascinating dynamic from what we saw when he was drafted, because he was a huge points guy, John, as you very well know, did have a little bit of physicality to his game, but he leaned way more to the offensive side. And while that is now part of what he does, it's not the thing that he is known most for. It's the physical side of the game.
Well, and on top of that, I mean, my recollection of Bennett with the Frontenacs was he was not a big player. He was not, you know, he was 17, 18 years old. You still got a lot of growing to do. And Lawson Crouse was supposed to be the guy that was the bona fide first round pick out of that group. And that to me is one of the challenges. And you talk to these scouts all the time of trying to figure out what a 17 or 18 year old is going to do 4 or 5 years from now.
Yeah. The guys who I think, for the most part, and Bennett's an exception, but like the guys who in junior hockey or where they're drafted from, who can translate their game identically to the NHL, are the superstars. So look at what Cale Makar did when he was in the AJHL. Look at what Connor McDavid did when he was in the OHL. Look what Patrick Kane did going back to his days in London, what he became in the NHL. All of those guys were known for their elite skill, their point production, and they found a way to translate that to the National Hockey League. So those, to me, those are your superstar guys. So, and then you have the other guys that have to find their way. And then you have the guys who just really know what they are. They have a good self-realization of what they are. I think Luke Shen is a great example of that. He too came in with such a high bar, being drafted 5th overall, was rushed by the Toronto Maple Leafs, didn't get a chance to go play in that 09 Memorial Cup with the great Kelowna team. And that set him back. But here's a guy who went to Adam Oates late in his career after spending some time in the American League and said, I have to change the way I go about my business. And Adam Oates got him sorted out to the point now where he's this coveted guy every trade deadline. Mm-hmm. And he's still making really good money, 2.75, I think, this year and for another year, well into his career.
Do you have a favorite player or favorite moment over the course of the drafts that you've covered where you loved a player and they either turned into a National Hockey League contributor or they rose up the pick list?
Well, you know, to think back on what my favorite guy would be, like one thing that sticks out to me, and you guys are going to laugh about this, but Pierre-Luc Dubois was a guy that I watched a lot in Cape Breton. And I thought, man, this guy can do everything. He can score, he can fight, he can hit, he can skate, he can make plays. He can do a number of things to impact the game. And so I felt really strongly about his game. And that year, Jesse Puljujärvi was a guy that people were talking about. And I went and did a mock draft. And John, you were in the room when we talked to Jarmo Kekalainen. I remember this very well. Yeah. We were at the combine and we were talking to Jarmo about Puljujärvi. And he just didn't seem to give a good vibe about what he felt about him. And I said, oh my gosh, I think this guy's going to lean a different way here. And Pierre-Luc Dubois was that guy. Now, Pierre-Luc Dubois, I think, has really found a comfortable spot. And is he going to be the guy that he was in junior? No. But is he going to be a guy who can be a Sam Bennett type guy out of the spotlight and not having to be that top line guy where people are expecting him to be where he was drafted, he can go and do his business now. And I think if you look at what Spencer Carberry got out of him, like really, really impressive stuff. So, you know, it's interesting to watch guys like that who you feel you have a real sense of what they're all about. The other thing to me is the 2015 draft, like watching, you know, Marner, McDavid and Strom wave at each other. That group, we had done so many games with that group. And I thought that was a really cool thing because I felt like I got to know those people as players, but as people as well. And I think about, you know, what McDavid had done and all the crowds that were being drawn to Erie. I think about the last game of the regular season that year, we did it, and it was a Niagara-Erie game. And Marner was actually leading the points parade for the OHL and pretty much had the scoring title wrapped up. And Dylan Strome went in and had a 6-point game against Niagara and ended up beating Marner in the last day of the year to win the OHL scoring title. I think it was 129 to 126. So I have really fond memories, Darren, of that draft because I felt like I knew the players and what they were. And now you're starting to see it with Dylan. We know what Mitch Marner's become. Obviously, McDavid is who he is. But that was a cool element because I felt that there was a personal side to things, you know?
The Dylan Strome story is a fascinating one.
Yes, it sure is.
Because I think if you look 4 years into his career, most of the hockey world had lost their patience with him. Most people thought that this guy had flamed out and had no chance to be exactly what he was. And here he is now in year nine, and has become exactly what everybody suggested he would become. And that, Sam, that tells you, and this is where the guys that you, the circles you travel in, you know, patience is such an important word when it comes to the draft. And too many people give up too soon, don't they?
Yeah, I agree totally. I look at like Tampa Bay, you look at Detroit when they were on their run of consecutive playoff appearances and just
they could afford to send guys after their junior careers to Grand Rapids for 3 years. Kenny Holland used to call that ripen them in Grand Rapids.
Yeah, and over-ripened in a lot of cases. So Washington's a great example of that. You know, when they won the Cup, I think they had 13 of their own draft picks that had played at least one game in the playoffs. And that's super impressive to me because so many times you hear about, well, look at Vegas, right, when they won the Cup.
And or Florida.
Florida.
I know exactly. they got the top guys, but beyond the first overall picks and the top five guys, they're supplemented with trades and free agents.
Yeah, and so it was neat to see Washington. But Washington, Hershey, you know, it's a juggernaut in the American Hockey League. And so they take their guys, they put them down there, they give them some sniffs of the NHL. Connor McMichael is one of those guys. We're seeing with Hendricks LaPierre right now that get a chance to, hey, here's what the NHL is all about. Get a little taste of it. But you know what? When the season's done here, you're going to go back and you're going to go and try and be on a winning team to learn winning culture in Hershey. You're going to go and try and learn to be a pro hockey player by learning from the older guys. And you're going to go where it's really difficult. Mm-hmm. And so not skipping the line and being patient, I think Washington is one of the best. But John, Darren, if you look at the top of their organization, right on down, Dick Patrick, Chris Patrick, you look at all of their scouts. Those guys have been there for years.
Well, Ross Mahoney deserves a ton of credit.
Russ Mahoney, of course. But those guys are all 19 years plus, I think. If you look at their entire front office listed on their website, some as many as 26 years. The consistency in the organization streams down from the very top. It goes into their upper management. It goes into their American League. And, of course, it proves its worth of what you see in the National Hockey League because they're a perennial playoff contender. And every now and then they're going to do what they did in 2018.
Has the value of a first-round pick changed?
Well, you know, every team has a different sense of what that's all about. I think the top 10 picks are always going to have that max value. But even if you look in round one, as you get past 10, to determine what is a superstar NHL career, which is, I think, a lot of people would associate with the first round pick, It doesn't really happen, or it diminishes by quite a bit the further you go down the list. So I think those top 10s will always have that intrinsic value. I think after that, a lot of variations can happen. You know, if you just take the pick in and of itself in a vacuum, there's a monetary value that's attached to it. And then there's the team value that's attached to it. And I think that for different teams, you know, it has a different meaning. So where you are in your continuum, because we can't just take the draft pick in and of itself and put that in a vacuum. It's very team dependent on where you are on your continuum of trying to become a Stanley Cup winner. So teams that are perennially in the playoffs are teams that you see keep trading away their picks because they're in win now mode, right? Like, look at the Toronto Maple Leafs. Look at where Florida is. They don't have tons of picks. They're willing to move off their first round picks. And then there becomes at some point a situation where now you have to go and then you have to really kind of get back to getting a number of picks and getting back and rebuilding. But the teams that I think do it best find themselves maxed out at the salary cap, in win now mode, and aren't afraid to trade their picks and prospects to continue to try and win now.
Frustrating for a scout, though. Works all year long and then comes into the meetings and the manager says, "Yeah, we're trading him. We're trading that spot. So thanks for all your hard work, but we're trading."
It's tough.
You know, I'll just jump in there for the first round. Yeah, but scouts can make a lot of hay and reputation on the third round hits, the fourth round hits along there.
Yeah,
that you're doing your work there.
Oh, for sure. And I think that's where you find the greatest value. Think about Detroit, you know, Datsyuk and Zetterberg, where they were picked and how they were able to ride those two guys in their top six as late round picks. So that's the real interesting part about that is everyone talks about Tampa and their runs, right? Three straight runs to the Cup final. Well, it was Cirelli, it was the Yanni Gourdes, or what you got from that. It was the Tyler Johnsons who were signed as free agent guys that were found late in the proceedings that were able to play such a prominent role. Obviously, that helps with the cap. Obviously, that helps with what you're doing in terms of depth of your lineup. And we are just seeing what's happening now with depth of lineup and how important it is to win the cup.
That, you know, it's funny you say that because that's never changed. And every year we have this eureka moment. Every year we say, wow, the team with depth, you know, always wins. I mean, if you look at Montreal in the 70s, you look at the Islanders in the 80s. I mean, Darren compares Florida to the Islanders.
Yeah.
The Islanders' depth was phenomenal.
Yeah.
Phenomenal. And even teams like Pittsburgh in the early 90s with Mario, they had great depth. They had guys that, you know, that could rise to the occasion in the postseason. That equation never changes.
And do you feel, John, though, like, I don't know if it's maybe, I don't know if the, I think very clearly going back maybe 10 or 15 years ago, you could make a clear delineation between your top six and your bottom six. And I think it looks to me a little bit more now like you have a top nine and an energy line or a checking line or a physical line where that skill extends now to that third line. I mean, look at Florida's third line. Brad Marchand's playing a third line and was, how close was he to surpassing Bennett?
But this goes back to the development you have seen and witnessed in junior hockey and now in the pros is that all 12 forwards on a team have skill.
Yeah.
All 12 forwards skate. I mean, they're what, you know, they, you know, 25 years ago, a ninth round pick, hard to believe there was nine rounds, but a ninth round pick couldn't skate. Couldn't really skate. And the only reason he got there was he was probably tougher than anybody else.
Yeah.
So that's the world that really has changed probably since 2005 when the rules changed, right?
Yeah, I agree. I agree. And so everyone realized that those players were becoming slow, more extinct as time went along, and that you had to be a skilled guy and you could go and be Tom Wilson where you could skate and where you could hit and where you could fight, but you were skilled and still could put, 30 pucks behind the goalie. So it is kind of neat how the game evolves in that way. And so much of it is based on what happens in the draft and teams adjusting to draft to what you envision, like speed. You know, speed is such an important part of the game. Now, your skating is absolutely paramount. If you can't do that, you're going to go later in the draft. Of course, they're going to work with you. And I do think there is room for improvement in that area. But man, if at first blush you can't skate, you're going to have a real problem. You can't pace the game now.
Coaches today have no interest in putting a player on the ice who can't score. And you don't have to score 50, but you got to be able to put the puck in the net every once in a while. And so if you're on a fourth line, you got to have some skill.
Yeah. And it's neat to see those guys. It's funny because, like, and you would know this, Darren, like if you go and play with an ex-NHL player, and regardless of wherever that player played and what you thought about that player and what their role was, you look at their hands and you're like, oh my God. And this is no disrespect to Nick Kypreos, because he was an absolute star in junior. But I think people's perception of what Nick Kypreos would be as a player, and then go play shinny with him or go play men's league with him. Yeah. And you realize, oh my God, this guy is the greatest player I have ever seen. That's just how good.
Do not tell him that. Do not tell him.
Oh no, don't worry. I won't tell him that.
Yeah. I'm sending him that clip. Sure.
Yeah.
but you know, like, I think that's a real good example.
Yeah.
And there would be skates all over, especially in the South now, where guys are getting together who have retired in certain places, and they go out and skate, and oh yeah, this guy was a fourth liner who played 8 minutes a game, and this guy was a second liner who played 750 games. And you know, in that venue, you can't really tell who is the better player. That's just how good and how skilled these guys are.
Well, I have a friend who not really friends, but an acquaintance, and I follow him on Instagram. And one of the great pickup skates is in Arizona, is in Phoenix, okay, with all the different guys that are skating. And he always takes a picture of the room. I'm like, holy cow, they've got a lot of talent in that room.
Yeah.
Ben's League.
Yeah, and I bet you're glad you don't go suit up for those ones.
Not a chance. It'd be a danger I get hit by a puck. John, are you okay to take a break, or do you want to?
Sure, let's take a break. We can talk. We need to dig in deep on Friday and Saturday. Draft.
Okay, I'm just going to go open the door for my son, too, because he's been pounding at the door, okay?
And we'll be back right after this. Back on 100% Hockey. Update for you. Developing story. Did everything go okay, Sam? Everybody in the house? Yeah.
He's in the house. Okay. Child services isn't knocking, at least not yet. So, you know, 15 minutes I got to run. You know, it's for real, and it could be taken away.
I didn't hear any sirens. That's good. So
we're in good shape for now.
This year's draft, and there's different drafts. There's top heavy, and then it falls off. There's the exact opposite, or there's just a really deep draft from brilliant prospects to guys that could develop in the middle of the draft. Where are we in 2025?
I think we're in a draft class that's probably getting underrated a little bit, not in terms of the high-end skill, but in terms of what you're going to see from role players. So, you know, you have the McDavid draft, and that's that. You have the McKinnon draft, and that's that. Auston Matthews. I look at this one a little bit more like 2020, where there's a lot of really serviceable players that came out of that draft class, but there's no real superstar. Tim Stützle is probably right on the edge of that. Mm-hmm. But if I look at Alexis Lafreniere, is he a superstar? No, but is he a pretty valuable player for the New York Rangers? Not as much last year, but the year before, you could see he's starting to come out. Jake Neighbors, perfect, like, second line power play guy for St. Louis. Caden Gooley, is he a top pairing D? He's right on the edge. For me, probably looks more like a three guy. So these are the guys that came out of the 2020 draft class. And you know, is it the superstar? No, but it's a lot of guys who are going to play important roles for your team. When I look at Matthew Schaefer, I think he's in a class by himself. And then after that, there's probably a list of 9 to maybe 11 names that I would be really happy getting that I think are going to be either top 4D or top 6 forwards. After that, I do believe there's a significant drop off in terms of those guys playing top line positions for you. But I think there's going to be a lot of guys that you're going to say, wow, really good penalty killer, third line checker, matchup guy, can play him with anybody, can play him up and down the lineup. He's really good with skilled guys, but he's really good being able to be a responsible guy who you can play in situations where you're up or down a goal. I think you're going to see a lot of those players come out of this draft class and not necessarily of the superstar vintage.
Is this so Matthew Darsh and the Islanders have the first pick. Is this one where he should be nervous because he can make a mistake, or is there enough depth amongst that top five or six players that he knows he's going to get somebody to contribute to the Islanders?
He's going to get somebody who can contribute to the Islanders. And Matthew Schaefer should be that guy. The only caution that you would have if you're Matthew Darsh is this guy's played fewer than 100 games in both his draft minus two and draft minus 1 years. And that can be a bit challenging. Having said that, John, the flip side to that is, while you might be a little bit concerned about injuries, while you might be a little bit concerned about his development, where you're not concerned or where you flip that around, you say, oh my gosh, we're seeing this in the few games that he's played, how good he can be. What is there left? Like, where is the ceiling for this guy? That's the way I look at it with Matthew Schaefer. I think an important element to where Matthew is, and unfortunately, the adversity that he has had to face as a young man, losing his mom, his billet mom, the team owner, all within a short period of time, that adversity is very difficult to overcome. And in every conversation I've had with Matthew, he's able to kind of get through that. But in the long run, having faced that at such a young age, I actually think it's going to help him in his hockey career. I'm not saying anything that he would, you know, for move on from the passing of his mom or his billet mom or the team owner. But I do think from a pure hockey perspective, it's going to help him later on. Now, John, if he decides to go another way, Michael Misa, exceptional player, he probably gets a little bit of the over-scouting stigma that's attached to players who you've seen for such a long time, and you start nitpicking as opposed to appreciating what he does really well. He skates well. He's got vision. He scores 62 of them this year, 134 points. Like, you're not going to go wrong with him. And if you kind of extend down the list a little bit, you're looking at an Anton Frundell, who was a projected top five and worked his way through injury and adversity, come back to be that guy. You're looking at Porter Marton, who's a winger, is a power forward type. You're looking at Caleb Desnoyers, who I think the world of, who can be a leader for your club and at the very least a second line center, projecting the play for years and years. So there's a lot of depth in that top five. And we're forgetting about Hop Hog New York's James Higgins, who, if they picked him, he's the hometown guy. Like, you can't lose in that area either. So he's in a really enviable spot. But I do think Matthew Schaefer is the guy who's above and beyond here.
So I asked this question on the basis of our discussion about Sam Bennett at 18 years old. Higgins is not that big.
No.
Isn't that 5'10", and that's 5'10" on a nice day.
Yeah.
Isn't that a concern in this day and age?
Of course it's a concern. I mean, I don't think there's any question about it, but you see the Cole Caulfields, you see the Braden Points who of similar size, and you hope that this player is going to overcome that. But like, I've watched Higgins a lot, and John, he has hit the key markers at all the deciding points. So under 17s sets a scoring record there. Everybody's played in the under 17s. The under 18s, he's 1 point ahead of Nikita Kucherov for the single tournament record of 22 points. Nikita Kucherov, McDavid's on that list. Like, everybody's on that list. He goes to the World Juniors as an underager. He's playing with two first rounders. And not only is he, you know, playing with them, he's driving that line. Puts up 9 points in 7 games at the World Juniors as an underager, centering the top line and winning a gold medal. So all of these markers to me are important markers in the scouting continuum. And he's hit them all, and he's graduated them all with flying colors. So you might worry about the size if he's going to be your number one center. And so drafting first overall, are you trying to draft the number one center? I do believe Higgins has potential to be that. But your fallback position is a two guy who's responsible defensively, who competes. He's responsible defensively, who competes really hard and has unbelievable skill. Like, that is still a really, really good fallback position to be in. And of course, everyone is going to be concerned about size with the bias of having just watched what happened in the Stanley Cup. And that's for real. But you also have to get guys that can get you there. And I think not only that about James Higgins, but he's smart enough that he'll be able to make his way through some of that heaviness.
there's different directions available to the top five teams. Are you more confident in who will go number one or who will go number three?
Well, I think at number three, you know, I'm still debating this through my mock draft. So he's either going to be two or he's going to be three for me. And that's Caleb Desnoyers out of Moncton. And I think I probably have him higher rated than most. But I think the world of this guy. He's this guy who's he's already 6'2", he's 185, 86 pounds, but he's got big hands. He's, you know, when you get a puppy and you're like, oh, that dog's going to be huge. Big hands and big feet. And so that's Desnoyers to a T. But he already has everything in place in terms of his skill. 30 points in the Q playoffs playing with a wrist injury. Wasn't great at the Memorial Cup. I think the wrist thing, you know, started to flare up once again. But he's been a leader in just about every team he's been on. He's got size. He's got skill. He can check. He can win faceoffs. He does everything that the game has to offer. And if you want to play it a certain way where it's going to get into the weeds one night, he'll get into the weeds. If you want to play a high-flying run-and-gun skill game, no problem playing that game. You need a matchup game. You need a little esoteric and an old-school style matchup. You're going to get that from Desnoyers. And I think the fact that he's able to do all of those things and do all of them really well puts him as a guy that I'm going to have two or three. So that certainty for me is not as much at this second as we stand here, you know, recording right now. But I feel very strongly and for sure Desnoyers will be two or three on my mock draft coming up.
How many kids from this draft, and this is a question owners ask, can he play for us next year? And how many kids in this draft play next year?
I don't think anyone plays regularly next year. I think
so. They're going to get the 10 game tryout, and then we'll figure out whether they go back to junior or college.
Yeah, or maybe whatever. The Draisaitl 37 game thing that he had.
That was an outlier.
For sure. But I do think it's a possibility here, because if I look at Matthew Schaefer, right, he hasn't played enough games, but he's liable to walk into a camp. And Islanders camp, and they're going to look at him and say, oh my gosh, like, we're going to give this guy a taste. We're going to give him a little rope. And he's the type of guy that might say, okay, you give me that rope, I'm not giving it back now, guys. And then you might get into a situation where, you know, you start thinking about the past a little bit, and then you start to realize that this is your job and you got to get up and do it every day. He's a guy that I could actually see going down that Draisaitl path, as rare as it is. But in terms of regular players out of this draft class that will play next year, I don't think there is one of them.
People are wondering now about the Draisaitl story. Can you guys explain it to everybody?
So gets drafted third overall, gets into some games one year, gets traded from Prince Albert to Kelowna based on the fact that Kelowna had a really good team and the Oilers felt strongly about what Kelowna was going to do. Mm-hmm. So this was all done after he had played 37 games, and the Oilers were like, well, he's not really ready for this. His only other option is junior hockey. We think we want him to kind of spread his wings in junior hockey as much as possible. Because he was drafted out of Prince Albert, he had to go back. And so he went back after playing 37 games. He bounced, right, John? He played a little bit in the AHL that year, and he played 37 games, if I'm not mistaken, with the Edmonton Oilers. And they just couldn't find a spot to maximize his usage. And so the only option was to send him back to junior. And instead of going to Prince Albert, which I think was in a rebuild mode at that time, they moved him to Kelowna, and they were obviously confident with the program set forth by the Kelowna Rockets, as most people would be, you know, a storied franchise in the Western Hockey League. So he ended up going back after 37 games. The 40-game mark, and John, you would know this better, there's a contractual...
You lose a year of your eligibility.
Of your eligibility. So, so you're one step towards the free agency.
The free agency, yeah. You don't want to go past 40. So
yeah.
So what happened was that, listen, Danny Lambert was the coach in Kelowna, and Josh Morrissey joined the team from Prince Albert as well, and they went on to lose to Oshawa in the Memorial Cup final in Quebec City.
It was, and as a side note, it set the table for Prince Albert to go back and play and win a WHL championship. What was it? Just a couple of years later, three years later, I think.
Yeah. So basically what they did is they took as much time as they could with Leon to figure out, okay, he's not, and the Oilers were still not very good at that point. And so it they took the year to figure out that Leon would be better suited to go through the WHL playoffs and to the Memorial Cup if they contributed, and that's exactly what happened. And then a year later, they drafted Connor, and Leon and Connor have been together ever since.
Yeah, and they're both pretty good.
Centers, defense, goalies, what are we talking about in this year's draft?
Yeah, okay. So the defenseman, really interesting. After Schaefer, there's probably three guys that fit somewhere inside the top 15, and it probably starts as early as number 8. Radim Mertko plays for Seattle, 6'5", kid, super lanky, playing pro hockey in Czech, didn't work out for him. He comes over to Seattle after the World Juniors, lights the WHL on fire, then has a little bit of a dip towards the end of the season, was just okay at the under-18s. He's probably the next guy on the list. Jackson Smith plays for Tri-City. His dad played in the WHL. Darren, you probably remember him. His name escapes me right now, but played in the WHL. He's kind of a two-way guy at 6'4", 205, 10 pounds, can give you some offense, can play defense, gaps up really well, excellent skater, moves pucks. I think there's some unearthed offensive upside there. Rumor is he's going to Penn State next year. We'll see how that works with his development. Kayshawn Aitchison out of the Barrie Colts, 6'1", 199 pounds, plays like he's 6'3", 230 pounds. An absolute menace out there. Open ice hits, fights, put up 26 goals this year, which to me was a little bit unexpected. I don't think the offense is going to translate to that level in the NHL, but a wonderful teammate, big personality, tons of swagger, plays an old school brand of physical hockey. I think those three are the next defensemen off the board, all within the top 15. And then it starts to dilute a little bit after that.
Wade, by the way.
Wade Smith.
The dad's name.
Wade Smith. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So then you're asking me about centers. A pretty good group of centers, mostly of average size, like between 5'10", 5'11 and a half, 175 to 185 pounds. Tons of skill, lots of work ethic. And the guys I would put in that class, Ben Kindle out of Calgary, Cole Reshney out of Victoria, and James Higgins, I think, is a lot like that, but much higher on the skill side than the other two, but the other two are not to be slept on. So you're having a lot of guys that are of that ilk, that are kind of average size centers who some of them will probably end up getting moved to the wing.
So how high will the first goalie go?
The first goalie, I think, has a chance to go late in round one. It's probably going to be a multi-pick team. Everyone's talking about Josh Ravensburg, the right catch goalie who's playing in Prince George. Jack Ivankovic's another guy who's at 5'11 right now is what his latest height was at the combine. That knocks 16 teams off of the list right away in terms of being drafted. But his dad, Frank's a big guy who played a little bit of goalie in the OHL at like 6'3 or 6'4. And I think people are projecting Jack to get to that. And if you feel very strongly in that, he might be the first guy to go. But you have Beckman out of the Quebec League. You have a couple of MHL Russian goaltenders that I think are really fascinating as well. You've got Medvedev, who played in London as the backup. So I think we see one in round one. But John and Darren, what I'd say in terms of your goalies, you know how we get that early rush on day two, and it usually starts around pick 40. I think it'll start a bit earlier, probably pick 35, where we start to see that run of – you know, three out of the next six picks are goalies, that type of thing. But I think because there's a number of multi-pick teams, I think we get one towards the end of the first.
Okay, so there's lots of different ways to look at this draft. It's the remote draft. You're going to LA to be there, but the people you normally talk to aren't going to be there.
I know, it sucks.
But that made the combine more important, correct?
It did, for sure. And people were able to get together. Now, I don't spend the whole week at the combine. We usually come in on the Wednesday and do interviews Thursday, Friday, hang around for what's left on Saturday. And so I saw a smattering of that, but apparently that was the thing, that a lot of guys were going there to try and get those conversations, at least those preliminary conversations, out of the way. I talked to one general manager who said, you know, I think we're going to have to preset things a little more this year. So if I have a you know, a couple of deals on the table, I'll have a very good idea of what that framework is before we get to the draft. And then calls made at the draft in their respective strategy rooms will consummate those deals. But I think it's a one and done, John. Like, the greatest part, I think, of the NHL and this day in particular is just how it's set up. Like, seeing all the teams on the floor, seeing a GM get up to walk around, seeing all the coaches, you know, wandering around the building, seeing the agents do their thing, seeing the kids and the hugs. Like, that's the greatest part of the draft. And it all kind of culminates in that big picture for the first round guys who have their arms around the commissioner, the GM, the owner, the head scout, and that line of 20 people who've put all that work in to draft that player. You're not going to have that. And I think we're really going to miss out on that this year, especially coming off the 24 draft at Sphere. To me, that was my favorite. I thought the visuals there, I thought every single person loved it. I think Vegas is probably a little bit too big in terms of all the hotels that teams can stay at. I like it when it's a little more concentrated because it's easier to go do your work and find out who's been drinking and who has the loose lips. But I think in that situation, John, the decentralized draft, I hope it's a one and done. And I hope that they take what we've heard Elliot talk a little bit about, is have that one big week where it's like the winter meetings in baseball, where all the suppliers, all the scouts, the agents, the free agents, all the players that are being drafted are all in one place at one time for a week long. And you do the draft and you do free agency in that city and you have one big celebration of hockey. I think that would be a cool way to go about it. But if we don't get there, we got to get back to the centralized thing.
You will be at LA Live, though, right?
Yes.
Doing the draft on location. I was worried that the broadcasting companies might not go and they would do it from studio, but it sounds different.
And the league is, I think they're flying 50 players out there. And so
I heard it's more. So,
well, I've heard up to 90, I've heard, but I would say comfortably 50 at this point. And so, Darren, like, it's for the kid. Like, this is a one, literally a once in a lifetime thing to go and get that photo, to hear your name. And so that element is still going to exist to a certain extent, but not to the extent that the buzz of having everyone there would have had of that.
This is an event that, you know, the commissioner's mellowing in his old age, you know, and you saw him at the draft lottery, Sam.
Yeah.
He's mellowed. And what he's allowing the teams to do is kind of pick, you know, the future and what would you like to do? And so they allowed the teams to vote, and the vote was that they wanted the remote thing. And what's going to happen on, you know, 6 o'clock Saturday night, it's going to be the commissioner saying, guys, I told you so, we're going back.
Yeah.
And so this, in many ways, this is Gary allowing the teams to be wrong.
Nice.
And then we're going to figure out and have it the other way. The other question is, and you touched on it briefly on one of the kids, he's not going to stay in junior hockey. He's going to go to Penn State.
Oh boy.
How I'm sure that's part of the discussion. Now you have with, you know, players and you have with your contacts, is how is the new NCAA CHL world going to affect all of this?
I mean, we're probably in a 3 to 5 year window where it's just going to be wild. And, you know, a lot of the buzz out there is that as soon as the draft is over, there are going to be a number of players that are going to move from their CHL teams to college hockey. And college hockey has also now put a rule in place where if that player goes and plays in the NCAA and he leaves, the team can't replace him. So there, even in that rule alone, there's a lot of different dynamics, because now I think as an NCAA program, you're going to have to be aware of that. So you're going to have to, you know, have more players on your campus that are technically on your roster. And so what does that mean for an 18-year-old running into an NCAA roster? The one thing that I will say in all of this, and it has less to do, John and Darren, with the logistics of it all, but just how I feel about development. At the ages of 16, 17, 18, and for most players at 19, I think of paramount importance that you need to play as many games as possible. Your hockey sense, experiencing different elements of the game, the power play, the penalty kill, the 5-on-5, the 5-on-6, the 4-on-3, the 5-on-3. All of these different things happen when you play more games. And I think that's absolutely imperative for players at that age for their development. Now, you're going to take a kid in Cole Rushney. I'll use him as an example. Plays in Victoria, puts up, was it 98 points last year, okay, on what was going to be a really good Victoria team. He says, no, you know what? I'm going to go play at North Dakota next year. And so there is no question that there's a monetary element to it. But now I've taken Cole Rushney in the first round. We'll get to the monetary thing in a second. I'm going to take Cole Rushney in the first round. He just played his 70 games last year. Wow, what a breakout year. I want him to go back and play World Juniors, play another 75 games, try and get up over 100 points, be that first power play guy, play in whatever other marquee events that the CHL will put forward, and really kind of keep progressing. Some people will say, oh, he's done all he can in junior and that's it. I don't believe in that because there's still that play away from the puck on the defensive side, face-offs, all that stuff. Every player can still use work on that stuff. But now you're going to go to Nodak. So you've just drafted this guy. He just had a great year. He's playing a ton of minutes. He's learning. You know, he's progressing. He's going to go into a college program where you're not sure what the landscape is. You're not sure what the portal situation looks like. You're not sure how many... I mean, you would be somewhat aware of how many juniors and seniors are there, and you're going to go and try and take a spot from one of those guys, and you're going to try and replicate playing 19 to 21 minutes a night, being a first power play guy. I just don't think it's going to happen. I just don't think that's going to happen. And so now you're a second and third line guy. You're playing 14 to 16 minutes a night. You're on power play two. Maybe you get some opportunities in the PK. 5-on-5 is going to be tough. And then you're going to go and take all your time away from the rink and you're going to work out and you're going to get bigger and stronger, which all of these players need. We can't deny that. I just don't know if that's going to be the best developmental path. And at that point, you know, technically, as it stands right now in the CBA, John, if he's drafted out of the CHL, he has 2 years to sign. Mm-hmm. So now Cole Rushney comes out at net 19 years old. Well, what's his option? To go back to the CHL? Or can he go to the American League? Like, so you're telling someone you're going to go play older, bigger competition, get bigger and stronger. By the way, thanks for doing that for a year. You're signed now. You go back to go play in Victoria. I just don't see the pathway. And I just don't see, other than the dollars, and they're, you know, I'm hearing some big dollar figures that are being offered to players. I'm not sure how they're working around the nil agreements or the recruiting or the alumni money or whatever it is. But it's my understanding that these players who are going are getting big, you know, big dollars and cents. And so that is always going to play a part, especially early when it's new to everybody.
What's big dollars and cents?
How do you guys feel about it? Like, Darren, you're around junior hockey forever. John, you've been on both sides of the fence when it comes to junior hockey and haven't spent so much time in the NHL. Like, I'm curious to think what you guys think about it.
Go ahead, John.
Well, I'm concerned from a lifestyle perspective, because there's lots of guys that are going to move from junior hockey to college hockey for the rest of their lives to improve their life. There's no question in my mind about that. But that's not the marquee players. That's, you know, that's guys that may never get drafted.
Yeah.
But the marquee players, I worry about, are they going to play enough? The other aspect I worry about more so is what happens to Owen Sound? What happens to North Bay? What happens to Swift Current? There are going to be small Canadian junior cities that are going to struggle. They are going to struggle because they can't compete with U.S. colleges financially.
Yeah.
And so are we going – the second tier, you know, we used to call it tier two as a kid. We're going to see, you know, the AJ and the BC League and the OJ and, you know, the one around Ottawa. We're going to see them struggle. I think even more than ever for quality players. They're going to become Junior B. They're going to become Junior B franchises. So I think the infrastructure of junior hockey is going to take a hit somehow. And it's going to take a while, but in the end, I'm worried about small town junior hockey. Not everybody's the London Knights. Not everybody's Windsor.
Yeah.
And those are issues that are going to affect, I think, junior hockey for a long period of time.
I'm with you on the small markets in the CHL, but I was more focused on the Manitoba Junior League and the Saskatchewan Junior Hockey League, because we've already seen a massive change mid-year this past season of players that went to major junior because they could and still play college and go that route. And it decimated a lot of the tier two teams. So we're in a, Sam, you said 5 years, we're in that window where we totally and truly won't know what the landscape is in junior hockey in Canada and the U.S., because there's some question marks about the United States Hockey League and trickle-down effect there of where this NCAA ruling is going to impact.
Yeah, and you know, John, like, I'm obviously a huge proponent of the CHL. I haven't done games there, you know, going back to local games for, you know, 25, 26 years. And so that very much concerns me. And, you know, at the start of all this, the CHL was trumpeting, hey, this guy's going here and this guy's going there. And I'm like, guys, you think you have a big win here, but you're not prepared for what the give is. There's going to be a give here. And I don't know if the CHL was prepared for what that give is. And now we're starting to see what that give is. You know, Gavin McKenna's name is widely rumored to be out there.
Penn State.
Yeah. Or Michigan State, I'd heard too. So, you know, that the chasing the money piece is going to be there. But I just wonder if chasing some money now costs you maybe the ability to sign your ELC, or, hey, maybe you go and get injured before you sign that ELC. And I say that this is the high end guys. The first round picks typically sign pretty soon. If you're coming out of the CHL, they usually sign not, you know, within that, whatever, 6-8 months, some of them sign right away. Mm-hmm. And so you at least put some money in your pocket. And of course, you're susceptible to injury as you would be walking across the street playing college hockey, CHL hockey. But the developmental mode that I think people chasing the dollars here early, it's going to hurt them on the developmental side of
hockey's
things.
Just catching up, though. On the chasing the money part from
the other sports,
there's no question. And hockey, just like it is in the Big Four, is probably going to be have the least money of any of those, those four sports, right? But I just think you need to play games, and I think playing games and development is more important. In the ultimate world, here's how I look at it. 16, you're going into the CHL as a top-notch player. 17, you're playing regularly and you're starting to shine. At 18, you're a star. Now you have a decision to make. At 18, have I done all I can do? Have I played World Juniors? Have I won a scoring title? Am I playing 22 minutes a night? Am I getting bad habits into my game because I'm just worried about offense? Okay, so I go back and at 19 and I shore some of those things up. Or I challenge myself against bigger, older competition. I'm more physically mature. I can get in the gym. I can work out. I can go and play there. And now I can play there for 1, 2, or 3 years. And now I've played, let's say, 3 years of junior hockey, 3 years of college hockey. After that 6-year window, I think I would be ready to go in the NHL. And I think I might be able to bypass the American League. And I think I will have had experience in two different developmental models. I will have played a requisite number of games. I will have had the chance to work on my body and physically mature even further to the point now where after 6 years, I'm going to go and make that jump. And now I'm just going to be an NHL player that, you know, for the rest of my career, the 8, 10 years or whatever. To me, that's the ideal situation. And maybe if I was a parent of one of those kids, I might not think that way, John. But sitting on the outside, that's how I look at it.
You know who that reminded me of? And this is going to be way out in left field. Is the kids who did that and went to Canadian college hockey.
Right.
You know, the Steve Ruchins of the world.
Yeah.
Scott Ward. Joel Ward, Scott Campbell, right? Wasn't it Scott Campbell in Winnipeg? The big defenseman? Anyway, so guys that, you know, had junior careers, went and played CIS or CIAU, whatever it was, and then came and played pro hockey as a mature 23 or 24-year-old.
Yeah, and we haven't forgot, like, the U Sports for Canadians who are watching this. U Sports is going to be decimated as well because there was a direct pipeline.
Until they find, you know, there's going to be a cycle because there's going to be enough hockey players. But it's going to take, I think you're right, 2 to 3 to 5 years to have everything settle down.
Well, and there's two not rules, but paths here. There's the top kids, the first rounders, yeah. the second rounders, and then there's everybody else. And it doesn't work the same for the guys that are drafted in the first two rounds as it does 3 to 7.
Correct. You're right. You're right. But that's
and I don't know how that's going to be fixed. It's just going to have to sort itself out.
Well, if I'm a kid who's just going to be, you know, working his whole life to get into a handful of NHL games, this is the greatest thing for me mm-hmm. because I'm going to go play in 4 or 5 years of junior hockey, competitive hockey, really good hockey. And then I'm going to go to 4 or 5 years of college. I'm going to get my degree and I'm still going to play super, super high level competitive hockey. So for those guys, that competitive window opens up from basically 4 years to 8. And I think that's unbelievable. But
see, the other thing I think should happen, Sam,
yeah.
on that topic is I think they should get rid of overage. I think they have to get rid of overage players. Let them go to college.
Yeah.
And make junior hockey that much more developmental.
And it would.
You don't want 20-year-olds in the league at all?
I don't want 20-year-olds in junior hockey, no.
Well, you'd have to go younger then. You'd have to have a bigger allowance of 16-year-olds.
Yeah. Well, but.
Which is fine.
They don't have a problem like that in the Western League.
No. And that's what I'm saying. That's fine. I think the CHL is going to have to understand that's probably.
No, it's all going to be part of, you know, this morphing into what role all these different leagues play in the game.
And you know, we were talking about Kipper before, and he said something really interesting on his show a couple of weeks ago, and it's really stuck with me. And he said that you think that, and the NHL does have some level of control with the mechanisms it can put in place contractually to have some sort of impact on this. But he said, do you think the NHL is going to allow all these different developmental entities to swallow each other up, to cannibalize one another? And I think he's right. Like the NHL should accept some responsibility here in terms of defining the path a little more clearly because, hey, these are the entities that are feeding your players. This is the future of your league. And so I do think that that's a really interesting concept. And, you know, to that end, Muskegon and Youngstown trying to get in the OHL, USA Hockey steps in, hey, you can't just leave like that whenever you want, protecting its entity, protecting two really good franchises in the USHL. So that's just one example of that. But we are in the great unknown, and I think we're there for 3 to 5 years, guys.
Like McKenna, like if he goes to the NCAA, like who gets his draft cash? You know, when you're the Canadian That's Hockey right. League gets a stipend or more than that for producing that player to the National Hockey League, they did everything they could, Medicine Hat, and then they don't get any of that reward.
Yeah. I mean, then that's, you know, there is mechanism wise, CBA wise, I think the NHL would have some level of being able to manage that, whatever the case might be.
It's hard to figure out what the NHL's role in all of this is.
I know.
You know, because they don't want to be seen as, you know, dictatorial.
Yep.
But they are the caretaker.
Well, are they? Isn't that Hockey Canada's role? Isn't that USA?
You got Hockey Canada, USA.
That's right. That's right. So, I mean, like the world, like, you know, we're in North America, we're the strange one. The rest of the world lives and dies with the IIHF. Yeah. Canada, the United States, we don't. And the NHL has a different role. And there is a point where, yes, they have to be involved. Yes, they have to be committed to making sure that there's still that pipeline. But, you know, they got out of ownership of junior hockey.
Yeah.
You know, that's ancient history. And you don't want to be, accused of being a monopoly. And that's a challenge.
I think that they owe it to themselves and the game to be more involved.
What they need to do is they need to be the guiding force. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure they can be completely on the front line about this. Lots of people want them to be.
You know what? He wants them to be the John Shannon of hockey, the guiding force.
Yes, of the entire league. Yes,
the hey, John by the way, Shannon.
By the way, how many? I'm going to do a drinking game on Friday night. Okay, how many times did you mention Gavin McKenna?
Oh yeah, it's coming up. There's no.
Well, question. He's no Gavin McKenna. Yeah. Or we're going to wait till next year, the Gavin McKenna draft.
Yeah. And you know what, John? While you're at it, why don't you add Landon Dupont into that mix?
Yeah, that's right.
For 2027. Right. So you'll have a.
Where are we going on Thursday night? I've got loose lips. Where are we going on Thursday night? I'll tell you everything you need to know. I'll be drinking hard.
Nice. See, I missed that. That's what we need. We need the centralized draft back for that.
I'll meet you across the street from Peacock. Any scuttlebutt about me? It's been 27 years since I was eligible. Any hearing anything?
Yeah, I think the NHL Senior League.
Okay.
Going to kind of be like the PGA Senior Tour.
There'd be a market for that.
The championship.
Can you imagine a six-team tournament with NHL legends?
Well, awesome. Yeah. We had that in the late 70s, and Ted Lindsay got into a fight.
Let's do that.
No, everyone loves each other.
I would pay to see that. NHL alumni.
Okay.
League.
Hey, the idea is born here. We have
right here.
The master NHL guiding light.
Yes.
To direct us. I am being equipment manager. You can play.
That's all we have to say is John Shannon said this is a great idea.
I'm not sure John Shannon said that.
But you were part of it.
I tell you what, though, I'd want to be a coach. I'd be a good coach. I'd be up on the boards. Oh, I'd be great.
Five tournaments a week a year. And spread out with six NHL alumni.
Yeah,
teams.
We'd go bankrupt by Christmas.
Vegas, Tampa, Sunrise, Nashville, Dallas, Utah.
Nashville's in there.
We got to go. We got to get out of good. Here. We're going down a rabbit hole now. Oh, my God.
I'll see you better than a snake hole. I'll see you on Thursday in LA ahead of the draft. Sam, thanks for doing this.
Yeah, thanks a lot, guys. This is a blast.
We'll play off the draft and the conversation just a little bit, but any possibility we can do the NHL alumni tournaments? Like, I'm thinking Chris Nyland lining up against Nick Kypreos. Like a battle there. Marcel Dion streaking down the wing. Might be exaggeration.
Here's the problem. Pronger would play and he'd beat the shit out of everybody. You know,
that's fine.
But the thing is that when you're a member of the alumni, you can be 35 or you can be 65. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not sure there's a 30-year gap in the NHL right now. It's between 18 and 38 for all intents and purposes. But when you have a 35-year-old playing against a 60-year-old, this could be crazy. We'd need 7 ambulances and a dozen wheelchairs at any time in any arena we would be at.
Imagine some of the guys that were middle six to bottom six guys in the National Hockey League. They could be stars in this thing. Kept themselves in shape. Way you go.
No, it's the guys that aren't in shape that I'd be worried about. That don't think they can play.
So you said the NHL commissioner, Gary Bettman, will make a soft statement in around his group on Saturday night. Hey, we tried it your way. We're going back to mine.
Well, I think he will. He will.
I think he's already said a little bit of that.
I think he has. I think he has. Cause I think that, you know, the draft and the event of the draft is a culmination, not just for the 32 teams, not just for the league office, but it's for those families and it's for the kids and the parents. It becomes a social event. It is, in many ways, it's the only time in the NHL year where all 32 teams are under the same roof and the future of the game is under the same roof. And why they would walk away from this is beyond me.
Give it a shot. I don't mind them trying this.
Well, no, now you're sounding like the commissioner saying, okay, we'll give it a try.
Yeah.
But we already don't like it. And we haven't even done it.
But we didn't know Sphere was going to be such a big hit last year. And they're not going to be able to put it in Sphere every year.
No, but I'll tell you what. If you told me that they're going to alternate between Vegas and Montreal, I would say I'm in. You know, Montreal, I've been lucky enough to do lots of drafts in Montreal. It is a special place to do a draft with the I think the most intelligent hockey fan in the world in that area. And then on top of that, the entertainment value that Vegas creates. So between the two, and by the way, I would probably hold it. If you wanted to save money, all the time, right, Darren? If you want to say we need to save money, put it in Canada all the time. Put it in Canada. I can save you 30% right off the top with the exchange rate. So, but
do teams like hosting the draft?
No, that's one of the other, this is one of the other issues. The draft, unlike the All-Star weekend, the draft is not a moneymaker for a hockey club. It actually costs the host city money. So that has become the problem.
But it's an NHL event.
But you still need to, you need to create an aura of sponsorship, an aura of branding. It has never been a really, really big moneymaker for a team. So that's one of the reasons why there has been very little appetite recently for teams to say,
we want
to host the draft. Yeah. So that's one of the issues that has got us to this point. So hopefully we'll get back to a traditional draft, you know, and in that way, it becomes, yes, good for television. Hopefully this way is supposed to be better for television, by the way. That's why they're doing this. This is supposed to be better for television. I'm not
sure. How will it be better for TV?
I don't know. I will have to wait and see on Friday and Saturday. So from that perspective, we'll see what happens. But, you know, the whole aura, I think, around the draft is something that's really important, that I think the NHL that has stood out by itself. You know, here's my soapbox for the day. We used to have an award show. And the award show was, you know, 500,000 people in the United States, 500,000 people in Canada on television watching. And it was an event. And it put our trophy case, which is the best trophy case in professional sports in North America, on a pedestal. We've gotten rid of that. We've gotten rid of the draft. And all of these tentpole ideas that have been so important to hockey for decades, we're pushing the envelope. And I don't mind change, but I also think we should recognize when we have a good thing going. And I think the award show is a good thing going somehow, some way, without trying to screw it up. And I think the draft was a good thing. And it, you know, I know it's a small thing and teams are trying to save money, but it's also...
Hold on. That's a fallacy. The saving money thing, if they do save money, it's very little, because yes, every team brings in their entire scouting department now to their home location,
right,
instead of to the draft location. Well, so they're still spending money on hotels and food and everything.
Right. But there's probably 10 people that are in your case, in Vegas, that won't travel. So they're saving 10 people. So so from that perspective, I want to reward the scouts. These guys are workhorses. They do such great work.
It's a chance to network for them.
It's a chance for
the coaches' seminar this year was held independently in Toronto instead of at the draft where everybody is.
And by the way, that coaches' seminar got very little attention because of it.
Yeah.
So, okay, we're decided. So we'll just announce that on Friday.
And one footnote, I think you mind change more than you let on, that you don't mind change.
No, I like change. I surprise people every once in a while.
All right. Would you mind if I changed us out of here and got on to our day?
That was a bad metaphor. That was awful.
Trying to end the
show. Did you just say goodbye?
So you don't mind change. I stand corrected. John, thanks for doing this. Appreciate
goodbye.
It.
Goodbye.
Bye.